Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The state's Cannabis Control Commission decided last week that it's not going to review agreements between marijuana companies in the cities and towns where they want to set up shop. This could pose hurdles to some marijuana business owners because the contracts required before a business can be granted a license to operate in Massachusetts, that contracts required in advance. And some are concerned that if the agreements aren't reviewed, they could go beyond the actual law. At least one group, the Mass Grower Advisory Council, which represents small and mid-sized cultivators and manufacturers, says it's considering legal action to force the commission to act. Here's Executive Director Peter Bernard.
The Cannabis Control Commission doesn't want to address it. We're going to go to the state and file an injunction to halt all licensing until the matter is resolved, because these illegal agreements can't continue. It's going to create a monopolistic environment in the Commonwealth, and that's not what this law was meant to do.
So joining us to talk more about this is WBUR's digital producer, Allie Jarmaning. Hello, Allie.
Hello.
So, Allie, what are these agreements? Tell us.
Yeah, they're called host community agreements, and they are an essential part of the licensing process. A business can't get a license, can't open, can't sell one bud without signing one of these agreements with the town they want to open up in. And there's some rules around the agreements. They can't go for longer than 5 years, and the community impact fee can't be more than 3% of gross sales. But, you know, in looking at a few dozen of these, I'm seeing stuff like voluntary donations, quote unquote, of up to $75,000 a year to minimum payments rather than a percentage of sales. And there are several that just flatly go beyond the 5-year period.
And why is it that critics are so worried about these agreements as you're seeing them?
Yeah, so the fear is that towns are going to use these agreements to either wring as much money as they can from the businesses, especially the big, well-funded cannabis businesses, and that that's going to shut out smaller businesses, especially those run by people of color, women, small farmers. These smaller businesses won't be able to afford the big minimum payments or the thousands of dollars in donations. And I've spoken to a couple small businesses who are looking at these agreements that are being signed and thinking, how am I going to afford that?
It does seem like that would violate the spirit of the law. I mean, these agreements might keep small entrepreneurs out of the industry, but they were supposed to be in.
Yeah, so the Massachusetts law is really unique because it specifically talks about equity for communities disproportionately affected by the war on drugs, people of color, people from communities and neighborhoods with high drug arrest rates. And there's a real concern that these groups will have difficulty raising the funds to get a business up and running, and having to shell out more money to a town because of a possibly illegal agreement just makes it even harder.
Okay, so the legislators who authorized the pot law, they specifically asked the Cannabis Control Commission to do something about these agreements in order to make sure they fulfilled the law. But the commission decided to stay out of these agreements. What was its reasoning for that?
Yeah, despite a big push from Commissioner Shalene Tidal, the commission decided they didn't want or couldn't review these agreements. One commissioner, Britt McBride, said she just didn't think the fears of Tidal and some of the others are going to come true. Other commissioners questioned whether the panel even had the authority to look at these agreements. And they also don't want to slow down an already slow licensing process. And finally, they think by stopping and reviewing these agreements, they're opening themselves up to a lawsuit. Of course, they might be facing a lawsuit regardless over their inaction.
Now, Allie, what do you think is the next step when it comes to these agreements?
So here's what I'm really interested in going forward. These agreements we're seeing right now, these are the towns that are welcoming cannabis businesses. They're the communities without bans or moratoriums in place. But there are about 100 cities and towns in Massachusetts that have a moratorium that'll expire over the next year or so. And here I should give a quick plug to a map we have on WBUR.org showing all the cities and towns that do have a ban or a moratorium. But for those cities and towns that don't want pot shops in their community, what is going to happen when they have a cannabis? What is going to happen when they have a cannabis business approach them? Will they use the fees as a way to essentially box out the businesses? And another thing that really interests me is that 3% community impact fee. Under the law, it has to be reasonably related to the impacts the impacts of the business, things like traffic issues, police presence. It can't just be used for, say, building a new school or paying salaries.
And do you want to give me an example of one or two of these agreements quickly that help illustrate the variability we're seeing here?
Yeah, Fitchburg, they are charging 3%. They're also charging they're asking for $75,000 in donations a year. They do say that they can renegotiate if it extends beyond the law, but that's just one of them that really stood out to me.
Yeah, thanks for that. So you've been really following this for our newsroom. There are a few places listeners can go to get more information, right?
Yep. We have our Green Rush Facebook group. That's where reporter Steve Brown and I share all sorts of cannabis news from WVUR and elsewhere. And we're always in there answering questions from listeners and getting feedback on what we should be covering.
And we'll have a link to that Facebook page and a map of the city and town moratoriums and bans at our website, RadioBoston.org. That's Allie Jarmanning. She's a digital producer for WBUR. Allie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, in other cannabis news, the state has approved provisional licenses for two testing labs to make sure that recreational marijuana sold in stores doesn't contain pesticides or mold or contaminants or other things you would not want in there. Now, one of them is Framingham-based MCR Labs, which utilizes a method that's a culture-based plating technique. We'll explain this a little bit better in a second. The other state-approved lab, CDX Analytics, is based out of Salem, and they employ a faster DNA-based method called qPCR. We're going to call that DNA-based for today. Both labs already service testing sites for medical marijuana, but they use different methods of testing. One uses this culture-based method. One uses the DNA method. And the difference in how this test works has sparked quite a debate in the cannabis science community. So joining us here in the studio to talk about this is Brianna Cassidy. Brianna is the chief science officer at CDX Analytics in Salem. And CDX uses the DNA-based testing method. It's one of the labs that received provisional licensing approval from the state. Brianna, hello and welcome.
Hello. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks. We're also joined by Chris Hudala, who is the founder and chief scientific officer for ProVerde Laboratories in Milford. Now, ProVerde uses this other culture-based method to test cannabis. They're in the process of applying for a license. Chris, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So I'm going to ask you two scientists to forgive me as I try to sort of explain the lay version of what the difference between these two tests are. All right. So we've got this DNA-based one, and as I understand it, it's based on real-time DNA sampling and is more immediate, but it's criticized for being less accurate. Now, the other, which is essentially using a petri dish to say, let's see what we can grow in here over several days, because what grows in here probably will grow out there. Mm-hmm. It's considered more accurate, but it's also narrower in what it might uncover. Now, Brianna, do I have those basics right on the DNA-based approach, or do you need to correct me on my science?
Oh, I think that's pretty good at a first stab, actually. I would like to say, though, that in terms of accuracy, which one is more accurate than the other, that's to be determined by looking at the published validation records of how well these tests can detect microbes that have been purposefully put into samples just to see which method can actually detect those microorganisms. And I think that's really the heart of the debate today.
Good. And we're going to come back to the heart of that debate just once we make sure that I got all my science right. So I'm just going to go to you, Chris, for a second. Did I get the basics right on the culture-based method?
Yeah, we actually use DNA-based methods as well as the culture-based methods, but for me it's about using the right tool for the right job. So if I'm looking for species-specific quantitation or identification, I'm going to use the DNA-based. But if I'm going to use an approach that is more geared for the regulatory requirements of the state of Massachusetts, which are based on colony-forming units, to do a total aerobic or a total coliform or a total yeast of mold, our feeling is that a culture-based assay is more comprehensive.
Okay, so I was actually going to ask next why each of you chose the method that you've chosen for your licensing in Massachusetts. So let me stay with Chris for a second and say, Chris, just to kind of put it in more simple terms, am I hearing you that you chose this method in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts because you think it's more accurate and meets the regulations better? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so the units of measurement for a culture-based assay is in colony-forming units. And that happens to be the units that were specified by the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. When you use a DNA-based approach, the measurement unit is different than colony-forming units, and it's an RFU or CQ, the number of cycles that it takes to breach a certain threshold. And my issue is the correlation between the units of measurement for a DNA-based technique and how to convert that into the units that were required by the DPH for reporting biological contaminants.
Okay, so we're talking about legal marijuana testing methods in the Commonwealth. I've got Brianna Cassidy, who's the Chief Science Officer of CDX Analytics here, as well as Chris Hudala, the Founder and Chief Scientific Officer of ProVerde Laboratories. Now, Brianna, let me turn to you. Your company has a provisional license with the state, and you've chosen this DNA approach. So I know it's controversial, so tell me why you chose it and why you think there's a dust-up.
Sure. There's three basic reasons, and Chris did a great job talking about that first reason. You know, it's what the state is requiring us to measure. And the state references the United States Pharmacopeia. So if you look into the USP 61 regulation, one of the first comments that they'll give you is that the ability of the test, the chosen test, to detect microorganisms in the presence of product to be tested must be established. So the number one reason that I chose the DNA-based technique is because the technique had been proven to a greater extent to be able to detect these microorganisms in cannabis than the culture-based method.
Okay, so that's helpful in explaining it. Now, we know that there's a controversy in the cannabis science community over the fact that the state has allowed both of these methods in terms of testing of recreational marijuana here in the Commonwealth. If there's controversy, then why do you think the state is allowing both methods? And I'm going to go back to Chris Hudala, mostly so I can get his last name right once. And Chris, I'll give you a first chance to answer that.
You know, I don't really know why. I think it's because even in the scientific community, there is not complete agreement. And so if the scientists who are doing the cutting-edge research are not necessarily in agreement, the regulatory bodies may not necessarily know where to fall on those type of guidelines.
And is that happening?
Go ahead.
No, that's okay.
I was just
going to
say, in at least one other state, the DNA approach has been prohibited for cannabis testing use, because of the concerns and the documentation that has been generated showing discrepancies between the two techniques.
And Brianna, why do you think the state is allowed for both?
You know, there is a lot of controversy about the two techniques, and I think that further validation with both of them is required. Right now, it's clear-cut that the DNA-based method has more data behind it, but that's not to say that more validation shouldn't be done. And the state that Chris Hudala is referencing is Nevada, and they actually are requesting that labs use DNA-based techniques for species-specific tests. So it hasn't been outlawed in that state. And in fact, California and Alaska have also joined this group of states that are requiring species-specific techniques, in which DNA-based detection has been demonstrated as a much stronger method than the culture-based method.
So Brianna Cassidy and Chris Hudala, this ultimately comes down to consumers. We have a group of people who are waiting for recreational marijuana to be available, and the state was originally slated, essentially, to do that on July 1st. Right. What does this, both the fact that we've got two preliminary licenses, that there are two methods of testing, what does this mean for the consumers out there listening who are saying, well, how am I supposed to think about this as a potential recreation marijuana user?
Well, I want to add to Brianna's comment. She's absolutely correct that qPCR or DNA-based techniques are the best method available for species-specific identification. There really is no better way to measure that. And we were very intrigued by this approach because of how well it does its species-specific identification. And so we tried to validate this approach for close to a year and a half. And we were not able to for the total microbial counts for total aerobic bacteria or total yeast and mold.
Okay.
When we were spiking samples, they were failing under culture-based assays but passing under the DNA-based assay.
Okay. And Brianna, As I mentioned a minute ago, mm-hmm. the legislation had originally had us scheduled for around July 1st right. for the beginning of dispensing recreational marijuana. Some critics have said that the licensing of these testing facilities has been part of the drag on the process. We're at the end of August now, and we really don't know when that's going to start. Do you feel the process has been particularly slow or burdensome? I mean, your company has received one of these preliminary licenses.
Right. Well, I think the Cannabis Control Commission, you know, their goal is to get this online to keep consumers safe and to keep everyone that's been expecting this to happen as least disappointed as possible. So I think that everyone's been moving forward as quickly as they can. It is slower than what was supposed to have been, but I think that everyone's moving as fast as they can, trying to keep everyone safe as they go.
Okay, and Chris, last word, what's the last next step for you?
Well, our progress towards the recreational testing license is currently being held up by the host community agreement. That's the last piece, and our town is requesting significant funds in order to receive that host community agreement. And so
All
that's
right.
really what our stumbling block is.
All right. I want to thank both of you for coming in, Brianna Cassidy and Chris Hudala. Thank you both for coming.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.